Today on Against the Grain, what is anarchism? Many now know it's not about breaking windows or planting bombs, but what are anarchism's core tenets, and what has anarchism looked like in practice? I'm C.S. Dana Ward, political studies professor and founder of Anarchy Archives, joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Is anarchism dangerous? Dana Ward believes it is, not because it promotes chaos and mayhem, which it does not, but because it frightens privileged elites and authoritarian structures. Anarchism, Ward argues, opposes all forms of hierarchy, domination, and exploitation. It offers, he contends, a viable alternative form of politics grounded in people and groups acting on the basis of cooperation, solidarity, mutual aid, and direct participatory democracy. Dana Ward is professor emeritus of political studies at Pitzer College and founder of Anarchy Archives, an online research center on the history and theory of anarchism. When Dana and I connected recently, he began with these comments about the historical emergence of modern anarchism.
Anarchism is a term that arose out of a social movement. Of course, there were earlier iterations of the term which were used by Greeks and so forth. But in terms of anarchism as an ideology, it begins with William Godwin in the end of the 18th century. Wasn't called anarchism at the time, and people don't call themselves anarchists for many decades later. And they went by a number of different terms. The early anarchists were mutualists. Many called themselves libertarians. And it's not until after the 1860s and the emergence of the conflict between Marx and Bakunin that you begin to have people seriously calling themselves anarchists. Of course, Proudhon was the first to call himself an anarchist, and that was around the 1840. His movement, however, was mutualist. But anarchism means two fundamental things. One is opposition to capitalism, and the other is opposition to the state. And it's those two areas where the philosophy has developed. You know, that's been the stimulus for thinking about anarchism, is thinking about capitalism, thinking about the state.
So William Godwin, who you mentioned, he was a British writer and thinker born in 1756. He came up with a critique of the state. What did he not like about states?
Godwin's a very interesting person because he was trained as his profession was a minister, and he was part of the dissenting community in England, which was opposed to the state church. And so many of the dissenters argued that their relationship to God was personal and direct, and there should be no intermediaries between them and their God, and that it was a matter of conscience, and no one had a right to interfere with that relationship. Well, the dissenters, of course, developed their own community, their own institutions. They weren't allowed to attend the universities and so forth, so they had their own universities. But they developed a counterculture, if you will. And out of that counterculture came an extreme antagonism towards the state. When Godwin lost his belief in God, he just transferred those arguments about why there should be no intermediaries between an individual and their God to why there should be no interference with the exercise of freedom by states. It's interesting that the impetus for the anti-state argument was rooted in anti-established church arguments. He was an extremely influential character. A number of important people were drawn into his orbit. One of the most important, I would argue, is Robert Owen, who is, you know, regarded as the kind of the beginning of socialism. Marx critiqued him as a utopian socialist, but Owen really got the socialist movement going. And when he had already written his first treatise, but when he was writing his second and third treatises, he was in London having lunch, often dinner as well, with Godwin leaning over his shoulder, whispering in his ear as he was writing, and he was very much influenced by Godwin. And Godwin's ideas kind of faded for a while. And there's the famous story about Shelley, the poet, who was inspired by Godwin. Indeed, Shelley's poetry is basically Godwin put to verse. And he came and knocked on Godwin's door. I think it was around 1814, 15, something like that. And basically said, "Oh my God, I'm sorry. I thought you were dead, but I learned you're alive. I've been inspired by you." And it goes on and on. And eventually, of course, Shelley marries Godwin's daughter. That's Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. Godwin had a great deal of influence through these other roots, through Owen, through Shelley and the poetry. But he also had a profound impact on the Chartist movement. And the Chartists actually published a version of political justice that they could fit in their pockets. You know, if you ever have the opportunity to go to the British Library and see Godwin's first edition of Political Justice, it's a remarkable book. It's huge, amazing paper to the feel. The margins are wide. And that's one of the reasons Parliament didn't censor it, because they figured no one could afford to buy it, so it wasn't a threat. Anyway, the Chartists produced a version of Political Justice in one volume, very, very tiny print. You almost need a magnifying glass to read it. But that had a profound influence, and that's that created an impact on the culture that between 1815 and 1830s and 40s inspired the workers' movement. And that movement, of course, eventually develops and becomes the International Working Men's Association when Chartists and Mutualists and others gather in London to form the International. So that's kind of a thumbnail of who he was and what his influence was.
And in fact, this International Working Men's Association was the famous forum for a clash between Karl Marx and Mikhail Bakunin, Bakunin being another foundational anarchist. Marx eventually had Bakunin expelled from this association called the First International in 1872. On what matters, I know this is a big question, but maybe you could boil it down to a couple of the essentials. On what matters did Marx and Bakunin disagree?
Yeah, for a long time, I went to Berkeley in the 60s, and I considered myself a Marxist. And during the Cambodian invasion, I was getting up and speaking about some issues and said I was a Marxist. But I had some basic disagreements. One was on the role of the peasants. I didn't, Marx regarded peasants as being potatoes in a sack. Nothing united them except their common condition, whereas workers were in a factory, and that brought people together where they could exchange ideas and so forth. So Marx thought that peasants could not play a revolutionary role. Bakunin, who grew up as a privileged member of the aristocracy, often escaped. Kropotkin did this even more, but Bakunin was very much aware of peasant culture and peasant ideas, and realized that peasants could be just as revolutionary as workers. So one of the fundamental differences between Marx and Bakunin is the role of peasants in revolution. Anyway, when I was talking about this, a guy came to me afterwards and said, you're not a Marxist, you're an anarchist. And I said, oh, come on, I don't throw bombs. That was my stereotype. But it stimulated me to go and look a little bit more deeply into anarchism. And another one of the important differences between Marx and Bakunin, and this is probably the most fundamental difference, is that Marx wanted a political revolution. He wanted to change the hands on the levers of power. He wanted to put workers in the place of capitalists, and then workers would rule as a dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, that's a term that I also had problems with. But if you examine Marx's work. He only uses that five times. In each case, it involves workers organizing. If they were free to organize, which they weren't, since they were a majority, they would win elections and, in the idiom of the day, dictate. So for Marx, revolution meant a political revolution. It meant changing those who ruled. Whereas for Bakunin, he didn't want to put new hands on the levers of power. He wanted to destroy the levers of power. He wanted a social revolution rather than a political revolution. He wanted to change the nature of social relationships. So that's the most fundamental difference between Marx and Bakunin. Anarchists would have nothing to do with electoral politics. They wanted to transform social relations, change the way we relate to each other, and create a horizontal society in which there's no one above, no one below. For Marx, there's always going to be someone above with their hands on the levers of power.
His name is Dana Ward. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Studies at Pitzer College. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Your very last comment there suggests that anarchists are not only against the state, are not only opposed to the state and want to eliminate it, but that they are opposed to any kind of authority or hierarchy. Is that correct?
That's correct. The term horizontalism is a recent term. It comes out of the Argentine crisis at the turn of this century. But it's a concept that was there at the beginning. It's one of the reasons that anarchists are also opposed to capitalism. Now, Proudhon, of course, is a very important person in the development of anarchism and in the development of Marxism. In the 1840s, Proudhon was the most important radical thinker of the time, and many people were attracted to Paris and came, and among them were Bakunin and Marx, who sat at Proudhon's feet. And Marx idolized Proudhon. And indeed, if you take a look at Marx's work, the things that are useful in Marx's work, alienation of labor, things like the surplus value, those all derive from Proudhon. All the crap in Marx comes from Hegel. So the useful critique of capitalism is something that Marx learned from Proudhon. And what Proudhon argued for was basically workers organizing among themselves, creating cooperatives, creating workplace democracies, where there was no boss, but people decided for themselves how they were going to organize production. So Proudhon, the idea of mutualism, helping each other, people being equal, that's right there at the beginning of anarchism. So you might have heard the phrase, no gods, no masters. And that summarizes a great deal about anarchism, the idea that we are our own masters and that no one can invade upon the right of private conscience.
Now, many people look to the state for help, for assistance, for welfare benefits, social supports. So anarchists are okay with these functions, what might be called benign functions of the state, being eliminated?
Oh, yes, because all of those functions can be performed through mutual aid. Mutual aid is one of the most fundamental values, one of the most fundamental concepts, and one of the most fundamental practices in anarchist history and thought. Maybe I should talk a little bit about Kropotkin. Kropotkin's comes after Bakunin. He was a little bit later. In the 1870s, he comes to Switzerland and gets inspired by the Jura watchmakers, who are anarchists, and joins the anarchist movement. And he eventually develops a new theory of anarchism, anarcho-communism. So Proudhon was a mutualist, Bakunin was a collectivist, and Kropotkin was a communist. And the central core of that idea of mutual aid came about in many ways because of his critique of the social Darwinist. The social Darwinists were arguing that our betters are superior and they deserve to rule. And that survival of the fittest means that those on top are up there because they deserve to be on top. Well, Kropotkin critiqued the social Darwinists by actually reading Darwin very closely and realized that what Darwin was really arguing was that it was not competition within a species that drove evolution, but that it was competition between species, and that those species that cooperated most were best fit for survival. And so he takes this idea of cooperation and develops it into a concept of mutual aid. And mutual aid is what would provide for all the functions that would normally be thought of as areas of state authority. So we see a lot of this today, even in emerging during the last year in the COVID crisis and in the protest of Black Lives Matter. And you see mutual aid organizations developing in a wide variety of places and providing the kind of support that states would have been, you know, would normally be thought of as providing. So there's no reason why states are best suited to provide for those needs. We're perfectly able of coordinating, cooperating, and organizing for our own mutual aid.
What about the notion that state and state institutions are uniquely able to coordinate large-scale projects, global projects, initiatives to, for example, address issues like climate change? Because, you know, the anarchists or anarchism seems to advocate for a kind of a radical decentralization. How could decentralized institutions, if certain institutions are, you know, things that anarchists could actually support, how could decentralized institutions tackle such large-scale problems?
That leads us to the next important concept of anarchism, which actually begins again with Proudhon, and that's the idea of federation. So there's no reason why you can't have a global federation as long as the arrow of authority doesn't point from the top down, but rather points from the bottom up. So anarchists have always been involved in organizing federations. So the way anarchists would attack climate change, for example, is that we would create community organizations, neighborhood organizations, maybe even starting at the block. Block associations, neighborhood associations, city associations, county associations, wider regional associations. But at each one of those levels, delegates might be sent and the issues would be discussed, but the level that had a wider geographical coverage would not have the authority to impose decisions, but rather a consensus would be developed among those delegates. Those delegates would then go back to the base. The base would then say thumbs up or thumbs down, and that's how you would coordinate, and you could do that at a global level through federations. So there's an important distinction between government and the state. There would still be government, like a federation, in which people get together and decide how to organize their lives. But there wouldn't be coercive authority backed by bullets to enforce those decisions. Those decisions would have to be arrived at through processes of discussion and consensus, and people would have to agree to go forward with any of the programs developed. So there's no reason why federations couldn't perform exactly the same functions as states.
Is coercion ever acceptable to an anarchist?
Well, in situations of self-defense, certainly resorts to violence would certainly be accepted by many anarchists. Now, there's a very, very strong pacifist strain of anarchism who would resist the use of violence under any circumstances, but there is, an equally lively contingent among anarchists who would resist violently, but only in defense, never initiating violence. So coercion is only acceptable in an emergency situation to prevent harm to yourself or to others.
And this issue of consensus that you brought up, you know, a lot of people might say and have said that you know, getting unanimous consent out of a group or anything close to it is incredibly time-consuming and cumbersome. And therefore, this kind of anarchist practice, which is, you know, as you are suggesting, is integral to the anarchist worldview, is impractical. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's impractical if you are involved with very large groups. Of course, the larger the group, the more interests are going to diverge, the more interests diverge, the more conflicts are going to be, and the less likely you're going to reach consensus. But if you divide the units of governance to smaller local levels, it's more likely that people have interests in common. We'll see the world in the same way, and it will be easier to come to a consensus. But yes, that is difficult. And many, some anarchists argue that majority rule should be the rule in some instances. But the ideal is to try to provide consensus. But if you go to majority rule, then the minority must have the right to secede, that you can't impose your decision upon the minority. So it's difficult in practice. Participatory democracy is probably a little bit easier to get things done. But in the end, you can't force a minority to go along with your decision.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Dana Ward joins me. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Studies at Pitzer College. He founded and he maintains Anarchy Archives, an online research center on the history and theory of anarchism. And he's written widely about anarchist theory and practice, including with Paul Messersmith Glavin, an article called Why Anarchism is Dangerous. And you can find that in Agency, which is an anarchist PR project. We've put a link to that article and to information about Dana on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, certainly a lot of people are really concerned about ecology and environment. What stance does anarchism take toward ecology?
That's a very important question, and one that goes way back in anarchist history. And the most important person in that regard is Élisée Reclus. He was one of the most important geographers of the second half of the 19th century. He wrote a massive universal geography, multiple volumes, some of the most beautifully produced books I've ever held in my hand. But he was an advocate of bioregionalism, the idea that society should be organized in harmony with nature. And it was indeed our obligation to assist nature, to improve upon it when we can. And his he had a number of different projects and so forth. But let me jump forward a little bit, because I think the person that's most important in this regard is actually the guy who drew me into the anarchist movement, and that's Murray Bookchin. Bookchin was very prominent in the 60s and 70s with his critique of capitalism and the way in which it ruins the environment. In fact, when Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, Bookchin had actually written a very, very similar book about the same time. It didn't have the same impact. But he was very much concerned with the environment, and his works are the best to take a look at it, the role, you know, how anarchists approach ecological issues. So trying to live in harmony with the environment rather than through exploitation. It was kind of a natural application of the anti-hierarchy idea and critique of capitalism, taking those arguments and applying it to nature as well, and that we should not be imposing our will upon nature, but we should be living in harmony with nature and helping nature when we can.
Let's talk about anarchism in the workplace. Some people might have heard of the word syndicalism, and specifically anarcho-syndicalism, which I think is sort of anarchism applied to the workplace, to workplace ecologies. What do anarchists think about enterprises and businesses and factories that might be different than the way socialists and communists might envision workplaces in the ideal society?
Okay, syndicalism, earlier I mentioned mutualism was the earliest iteration of anarchism. Collectivism was Bakunin. Communism was Kropotkin. Syndicalism emerges later, in the late 19th, early 20th century. And a syndicate is simply the European name for a union. And the idea of syndicalism is that it would be the workplace that would basically govern the society. And the way that would operate is that workers would own and operate the enterprises. This is an idea that goes back, for example, to the IWW. The IWW in the United States was in many ways a syndicalist organization, and it brought in both Marxists and anarchists. But the idea was that if you organized all of the workers, that the way to create fundamental change is to create a general strike. So if everybody is organized into one big union and the union goes on strike, the economic system collapses, the workers take over, and would begin to operate the enterprises. Now, the first time that workers seized the means of production and began to operate on the basis of worker-owned and operated enterprises is back in the Paris Commune, and that's what makes the Paris Commune so important, is it's the first instance of that. But as time developed, of course, probably the best example is during the Spanish Civil War. Anarchists had organized workers' unions, had created a very, very wide network. And when the fascists rose in 36, and Orwell was there to see it, he was amazed that in Barcelona, basically, they didn't skip a beat. Bread was baked, electricity was produced, water flowed through the pipes, and it was because the anarchists had spent decades organizing workers, and when the capitalists fell, they simply stepped in and took over. We see the same thing happening in the recuperated enterprise movement in Argentina in the 2000 crisis. Capitalists were dismantling their factories, selling the equipment. The workers occupied the factories, put them back into production. They created 10,000 jobs, well over 100 different enterprises, became worker-owned and operated. And basically, that's how economic relations would be conducted in a anarchist society. The workers would hire managers, but the managers would be responsible to the workers. If the managers failed to provide the materials that the workers needed to produce, the managers would be fired and replaced. So you would still have a need for coordination and management, but it's a question of to whom are those managers responsible. A contemporary example of such an organization would be Mondragon in Spain. This was not specifically anarchist at all. It was, in fact, started by a Jesuit priest after World War I. But that's evolved into over 100 enterprises that are owned and operated by the workers. And this includes capital-intensive, labor-intensive, agricultural, industrial, financial, educational, all kinds of different enterprises. But in all of those enterprises, it's the workers who make the decisions, not the managers.
His name is Dana Ward. He's an educator, a writer, founder of Anarchy Archives on the Web. We'll take a short break and speak more with Dana about anarchist theory and practice and history. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Dana Ward is Professor Emeritus at Pitzer College, where he taught political studies for many, many years. And we have posted a link to Anarchy Archives, which he founded and maintained. It's an online research center, as well as the article that he and Paul Messersmith Clavin contributed to the online resource agency. It's an article called Why Anarchism is Dangerous. So worker-owned and operated enterprises sound certainly very appealing, and certainly worker cooperatives have been springing up and emerging. What about the issue of whether these enterprises can be as productive and, quote, competitive as capitalist enterprises, which, of course, are often lauded by mainstream economists as, you know, the way to combine productivity and efficiency?
Yeah, that's a very important issue. And it's one of the literatures I've been following for 40 years, and I follow a number of other literatures, but few have been as consistent in their finding as the literature on worker-owned and operated enterprises, and that is that they are more efficient and more productive than capitalist enterprises. And one of the studies was actually done by the IRS when the plywood industry in the northwest of the United States, after the end of World War II, the IRS had to decide about how to tax the profits, because the profits were shared equally among the workers, and there were bonuses at the end of the year, and they had to decide whether to tax that as capital gain or as wages. And of course, the rates are different. And so they had to decide, examine how much was produced by the workers and so forth. Anyway, they came to the conclusion that in fact, it's more efficient generally than similar capitalist enterprises. They decided to go with wages rather than capital gains, as by the way. But the reason that worker-owned and operated enterprises are more efficient and more profitable is that you reduce the policing functions that are necessary in a capitalist enterprise. If you're the worker and you own that enterprise, and it's Friday afternoon and it's a beautiful day outside, you're gonna show up to work rather than go to the beach, because you know that your fellow workers are depending upon you and that the rewards for you going to work will be returned to you. And so you see, for example, much lower turnover in worker-owned and operated enterprises, and that's part of what makes them more efficient, because training new workers is one of the biggest costs in capitalist enterprises. And you have new people coming in over and over and over, you're spending more of your time training than producing. So aside from greater longevity is that there are fewer accidents at work. There are fewer stoppages because some accident has happened, because workers know that they're responsible for their working conditions and they're not going to work in dangerous situations that could give rise to having to stop the production. And so for a number of reasons, worker-owned and operated enterprises, when you match the type of enterprise in terms of whether it's capital intensive or labor intensive, agricultural or industrial, if you match worker enterprises with capitalist enterprises, worker enterprises always win, not sometimes, always.
So certainly the workplace is one of those spaces in which anarchist principles can be realized. How important to anarchism is the creation of, say, non-workplace spaces? Creation of those spaces by anarchists to practice what they preach, to implement, to put into practice what they believe.
And one of the things about anarchism is that it has evolved out of practice. And one of the things that syndicalists and people in Argentina realized is that there's more to life than work. And that it's not just the workers who are affected by what a factory or an office or a company does, but the surrounding community is affected as well. So, for example, in Argentina, one of the things that happened in the recuperated factory movement was that they created neighborhood councils. And neighborhood representatives are also involved in part of the decision-making process. But there are all sorts of other areas of life that need to be organized besides the factory. And so, for example, education is another area in which anarchists have been very much involved almost from the beginning. One of the most important figures in that regard is Francisco Ferrer, the Spanish educator who basically gets hung by the Spanish authorities for challenging the Catholic Church's monopoly on education. But in essence, what the modern school movement that he founded emphasizes is what today people are probably familiar with Montessori. It wasn't in any way affected by Ferrer's ideas, but it's a similar kind of idea where it's the child that leads the direction of the education. It's a child-centered education in which the role of the educator is to facilitate the learning, let the student take the lead, and then the adults or the educator provides the materials and the resources that the student needs to be successful. So education has been one of the areas where anarchists have created institutions outside the educational structure. Emma Goldman and Berkman and a number of the New York radicals were involved with the modern school in Stelton in New Jersey. There have been several examples such as that. So there are a wide variety of areas outside work where similar ideas can be applied to education, to healthcare, and so on. So it's the workplace alone is not enough. You have to create cooperative organizations in every area of human activity.
You have said, Dana, that if tomorrow we woke up and we were in an anarchist society, it would be a disaster. Why?
Because it's important that we have a shared set of values. We need to have skills. And decision-making and social organization are difficult. They're not easy. You need practice. I once, for my dissertation, I did a series of interviews with the children of working class adults. These were adult children. Their parents had been interviewed by Robert Lane back in the 60s. I interviewed the adult children. And one of the things I noticed is that their concepts of democracy, the children's concepts of democracy, in many ways were much less developed than the parents. The parents were involved in social organizations. They were involved in PTAs, in unions, in neighborhood organizations. The children, when I interviewed them, and again, they're adults, I asked them about the organizations that they were involved in, and there was a remarkable lack of organizational involvement. Few members of unions, few involved in PTAs. And the consequence of that is that they weren't exposed to the procedural face of democracy. And as a consequence, they had a poor grasp of what the principles of democracy are. And so if you asked, I asked one of my subjects, you know, what is democracy? What does it mean to you? And she said, oh, it means you can go into any supermarket you want and buy anything you want. Well, you know, that was her daily life, and she recapitulated it as democracy. She knew we lived in a democracy, so that must be what it is. So to the extent that we're not involved in cooperative decision-making, we don't have the skills, don't have the ability to make the compromises and to listen to other people so that we can come to some kind of collective consensus. So in other words, we need a process of socialization that involves the ways in which we are educated as children and the way in which we interact as an adult in a consensual, mutually respectful way. And without that kind of socialization, to simply expect that everybody suddenly, the day after the revolution, are able to function appropriately is really dreaming. And so we need, for me, for anarchism to reach its goals, we have to take the long view. We have to develop social institutions that provide people with the opportunity to develop skills of self-government.
His name is Dana Ward. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Studies at Pitzer College, where he founded and he maintains Anarchy Archives. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I hear what you're saying, Dana, about a lot of preparation and socialization needing to happen, but doesn't that kind of feed into this notion of anarchists as dreamers? Because it would seem to me, under current conditions, that, you know, that kind of value setting, that kind of inculcation of values of mutuality and reciprocity and horizontality. I mean, you know, we're talking about years, possibly generations before people could be primed to be anarchist and for the society, more importantly, for a society as a whole to be anarchist.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying as well. But if you think back, when I became an anarchist in the 70s, there was no anarchist movement. Of course, there was a radical movement that I was a part of, but it was certainly not consciously anarchist, even though Andy Cornell's book, Unruly Equality, shows how there were threads of anarchism that go back to the classical movement that were perpetuated. But basically, there was no anarchist movement. It's not until the 90s, with the organization against the WTO, that we begin to see a resurgence of anarchism. And then, of course, you see Occupy Wall Street come on, which was, of course, stimulated by the anarchist culture jamming group. And David Graeber, of course, had a great impact on the organization of Occupy Wall Street. But what that shows is that over the course of a generation, we move from no understanding of how to organize ourselves in a horizontal way to it becoming today, that position is now kind of the default on the left. If you look at what happened over the summer, mutual aid organizations, horizontalism, all of the basic practices that an anarchist emphasized for a century and a half, that has become kind of a natural way of relating for those of us on the left who are organizing and trying to change what's going on in our society. So yeah, it takes time, but we see evidence of that evolution right in front of us. We see evolution of mutual aid societies, horizontalism and so forth, very clearly, and I think it will only grow in the future.
I think you've made the argument that there have been two instances of anarchism being achieved in practice on the societal level. One, you've already mentioned, kind of the Spanish Revolution within the Spanish Civil War. So we're talking about the 1930s. The second is what happened in Ukraine from beginning in 1918. So this is just after the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. Nestor Makhno's name is associated with this, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Nestor Makhno was a military genius in many ways, and he inspired an anarchist revolution in the Ukraine that was very short-lived. It wasn't nearly as developed as, for example, in Spain. But they did manage to redistribute property, begin to organize themselves on a horizontal basis. Unfortunately, and this is a problem in many of these instances, this was in the middle of war, and it was outside forces that destroyed Makhno. It was basically Trotsky. The anarchists were too much of a threat to the Bolsheviks. Even though it was the anarchists that saved the Bolsheviks' bacon in many, many cases early on in the revolution, the Bolsheviks betrayed the anarchists, went down, essentially slaughtered many. The Bolsheviks probably killed more anarchists than they killed capitalists. So that points up a weakness in anarchist theory that I don't think anybody has really managed to come up with, and that is the threat from outside military force. And that's one of the issues that we have to address. But there have been many other examples of what, as well. Today, the Rojava Revolution in Syria. That was inspired by Murray Bookchin. Öcalan was imprisoned in the Turkish prisons. He got a hold of Bookchin's work, and those ideas spread among his followers. And we see an example of that kind of organization. But again, it's in the midst of war, and it's threatened by outside forces, and it could very easily be destroyed by military interventions. Even if you go back to the 1820s and 30s, in that period, before there was a mass movement, the anarchist examples were small utopian communities like the Times Store, the Cincinnati Times Store, and Modern Times, and so forth. And very often, they're outside forces that are intolerant of the behavior of the anarchists that come in and, you know, mess things up. So that is a strategic problem that anarchists are going to have to grapple with, because there will always be outside forces who will try to put us down.
Direct action is one way in which anarchists try to fight back, to struggle. How do you define it? And should direct action be associated specifically with anarchism, or should it be associated more generally with kind of, at least on the left, anti-capitalist action?
Yeah, direct action is a very important concept. It is not specifically anarchist, although I would argue that anarchists were very much involved in the development of the idea. And Voltairine de Cleyre, who's an early 20th century American anarchist, she wrote a pamphlet on direct action that you can pick up on in Anarchy Archives, and it's very important. And one of the issues about direct action is whether or not it means violent or nonviolent direct action. Detractors tend to see the violence involved, but direct action does not have to be a violent confrontation. It can be a nonviolent confrontation. It can be a sit-in. It can be destroying draft card records, destroying tax records, which they did in Spain, for example. So direct action means that you don't wait for somebody else to take responsibility for rectifying an injustice. It's our responsibility to confront injustice and to correct wrongs.
Let's turn in the time remaining to something I know that's dear to your heart and to many anarchists' heart, which is cultural production. And, you know, you've referred to this over time, but how important has cultural production been to anarchists internationally, really?
Oh, this is one of the areas that I find most fascinating. What many people are probably unaware of is that all of the neo-impressionists were anarchists. The whole idea of pointillism from Seurat, that is an anarchist conceptualization. It's the idea that every individual dot is an individual, but the overall image only comes into view when you step back and you see all the individuals coordinated together.
So here, Dana, we're talking about the movement in painting, correct, associated with Seurat and Pissarro and the like?
In painting, but not just in painting. It's also in literature, and it has an impact on Dada. And, for example, Seurat's agent, Félix Fénon, was a writer, and he expanded the anarchist, or applied the anarchist ideas, and created a genre called a novel in one sentence. So there were a variety of cultural outlets, literature, painting, sculpture, that were influenced by anarchists. And well, I guess it was Leon Blum who, I may be wrong on this, but I think it was Leon Blum who said, we're all anarchists now. Because the anarchists changed the conversation. They changed the way people thought about painting. And from Impressionism, all the other modern art movements developed out of that. They broke the mold and created a new way of thinking. And that's pretty much what anarchist cultural production can do. It can change the conversation. And anarchists have been very conscious about how important art can be in moving the ideas forward.
Tell us about the infamous picnics, the infamous anarchist picnics.
That's another example of how important cultural activities were. In, this occurred in Spain all over, but I think one of the great examples is out of Chicago in the 1880s. In the 1880s, the anarchist movement was extremely strong in Chicago, and of course, that's where you get the Haymarket martyrs. But the anarchists had organized the entire life of workers was organized around things like gymnastics. We would call it tumbling today, but this was a, you know, physical exercise became a deal. So everybody got involved in this, and they joined gymnastic clubs. They had hunting clubs, rifle clubs. They had choirs. They had theater companies. And people would get together and they would go out on Sundays and Saturdays or whatever, and they would get together and they would engage in all of these activities. And it was a form of community building, and it was a form of creative expression. It created a real deep sense of community among the anarchists in Chicago. And the authorities recognized that this was a problem. And so they were on a constant campaign to cancel the leases for the gymnasiums, to cancel the leases of the taverns, because taverns, beer halls and so forth, were a very important gathering place where anarchist ideas were spread. In fact, there's a wonderful book called Beer and Revolution that focuses on New York, and you can kind of see the spread of anarchist ideas attached to where people came to drink. Probably the most famous story is when Emma Goldman came to New York on her first day. She's a complete newcomer. She has one address of someone who was involved in the movement. She goes to a restaurant where immediately she encounters a dozen other anarchists, most importantly, Alexander Berkman, with whom she develops a lifelong relationship. You know, that shows how important these cultural, social locations are. It's where people can get together, share ideas, meet other like-minded people, and all forms of cultural production do that. They create an audience, they create a crowd, and it creates the opportunity to promote anarchist values, ideas, and organizations.
Dana Ward, Professor Emeritus of Political Studies at Pitzer College. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to Anarchy Archives, an online research center on the history and theory of anarchism that he founded and that he still maintains. You can also check out an article that he co-authored with Paul Messersmith-Glavin called Why Anarchism is Dangerous. Dana, thanks so much for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Been my pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.